It was during the Bosnian War in the 1990s that a small medieval Hebrew prayer book was saved from the fire of bombs in Sarajevo. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today we're taking a fascinating trip between the lines of People of the Book by Pulitzer Prize winner Geraldine Brooks. The book is the Sarajevo Haggadah, a book both loved and hated by different cultures throughout the ages. Geraldine, it's good to see you again. Welcome back to Between the Lines.
So good to be back with you, Valerie.
This is a fascinating book. I enjoyed this as much as March, you know, which is saying a lot. But you cover 5 centuries of war, scandal, secrets, and characters that deserve their own spinoffs, I might add. But first, Geraldine, let's point out that this is, in fact, a work of fiction based on real documents, or a real document. Give us a little history, if you will, of the Sarajevo Haggadah.
This was a book created in Spain sometime after 1350. So we're in a medieval setting here. And it's a time when Jews and Christians and Muslims are living together in Spain, if not always in perfect amity, then at least in mostly peaceful coexistence. And they're being influenced by each other artistically, scientifically. Great exchanges are going on. And the Haggadah is a product of its time in that it's a Hebrew book. It's the little book that's used at the dinner table in Jewish homes while celebrating the Feast of Passover, which, as you know, celebrates the liberation of the Jews from slavery in Egypt. But what's outstanding and different about this volume to others created at the same time is that it's lavishly illustrated with beautiful miniature paintings. And at that time, figurative art didn't really exist among Jews because of the prohibition in the Bible, thou shalt not make any graven image or likeness of anything. So you have here a book that's got beautiful pictures in it. And it's a product of a time of tolerance, but then it comes under threat when the rise of the Inquisition leads Ferdinand and Isabel to expel first all the Jews and then all the Muslims from Spanish territory.
And then, of course, with expelling the Jews, they expelled all their books, their arts.
They destroyed
it all.
Many of them.
The part of the what I found that I didn't know before was that the Haggadah is the part of the Talmud that's not really concerned with religious law, and correct me if I'm wrong, but devoted more to folklore and legends, if you will,
well,
of the heroes.
It's not exactly. What it is, it's a retelling of the story about how Moses stood up to Pharaoh. It's the let my people go story. And the way it is told in Jewish homes, even today, is in a kind of Socratic question and answer thing, because the idea is to teach the kids about this story. The Bible says, you shall teach it to your children on that day. And so it's the whole story of putting the blood on the doorpost and the plagues of Egypt. And so all of this information is conveyed while you're eating a usually very good meal with a lot of symbolic foods involved, like you would eat matzah, which is unleavened bread, because the Hebrew people didn't have time to let bread rise because they knew they'd have to make a quick getaway. And so all these kind of details. And so it's that story told in a kind of there are traditions about how you tell it, but that's what's basically going on in the book.
Well, books are obviously a very big part of my life, and I've yet to knowingly discard any book that I've ever had in my life. I've given some away, but I've never destroyed or discarded a book, because to me there's an energy or a spirit, if you will, in each book. There's a passage in the beginning of your book, People of the Book, that speaks to that feeling I have. It's on page 19. Would you read that for us, please?
Yeah, this is in the voice of Hannah, who's a book conservator, and she's been called in to work on this manuscript. Of course, a book is more than the sum of its materials. It is an artifact of the human mind and hand. The gold beaters, the stone grinders, the scribes, the binders, those are the people I feel most comfortable with. Sometimes, in the quiet, these people speak to me. They let me see what their intentions were, and it helps me do my work. I worried that the custos, with his well-meaning scrutiny, or the cops, with the low chatter of their radios, would keep my friendly ghosts at bay. And I needed their help. There were so many questions. For a start, most books like this, rich in such expensive pigments, had been made for palaces or cathedrals. But a Haggadah is used only at home. The word is from the Hebrew to tell, and it comes from the biblical command that instructs parents to tell their children the story of the Exodus. This telling varies widely, and over the centuries, each Jewish community has developed its own variations on this home-based celebration. But no one knew why this Haggadah was illustrated with numerous miniature paintings at a time when most Jews considered figurative art a violation of the commandments. It was unlikely that a Jew would have been in a position to learn the skilled painting techniques evinced here. The style was not unlike the work of Christian illuminators. And yet, most of the miniatures illustrated biblical scenes as interpreted in the Midrash, or Jewish biblical exegesis. I turned the parchment and suddenly found myself gazing at the illustration that had provoked more scholarly speculation than all the others. It was a domestic scene. A family of Jews, Spanish by their dress, sits at a Passover meal. We see the ritual foods, the matzah to commemorate the unleavened bread that Hebrews baked in haste on the night before they fled Egypt, a shank bone to remember the lamb's blood on the doorpost that had caused the angel of death to pass over Jewish homes, the father reclining as per custom to show that he is a free man and not a slave, sips wine from a golden goblet as his small son beside him raises a cup. The mother sits serenely in the fine gown and jeweled headdress of the day. Probably the scene is a portrait of the family who commissioned this particular Haggadah. But there is another woman at the table, ebony-skinned and saffron-robed, holding a piece of matzah, too finely dressed to be a servant and fully participating in the Jewish rite. The identity of that African woman in saffron has perplexed the book's scholars for a century.
And it's a fascinating part of the story. Yes, I like
Oh,
that.
I had so much fun making her up. Because, of course, we can't know who she really is.
Right,
and
right.
That illustration is in the actual book.
And I keep forgetting that you're making this up. Okay, the book is the Haggadah. And so the title, People of the Book, I think you referenced it, actually, in the beginning paragraph when you talked about the bookbinders, all of those people
who made the book, who protected the book. But it's got a little resonance because in the Quran and I think in Jewish tradition, we speak of people of the book, meaning Jews, Christians, and Muslims who have a sacred text at the heart of their religion. So for Muslims, obviously, it's the Quran. For Jews, the Torah or Hebrew Bible. And for Christians, the Old and New Testament. So all of the three monotheistic faiths are people of the book.
Ah, good. Now, you mentioned Hannah, the narrator of the story, and you mentioned she was a conservator. Is that how you
pronounce it? That's right, yeah.
And there's a distinction made in the book between people who restore books and those who are conservators. Let's speak to that for a moment, because I found that interesting.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many things I didn't know before I started this book, but one is that there's a great debate underway about how you should handle ancient manuscripts, and sometimes they are subjected to very extreme chemical cleanups, and the idea is to make the book look as it would have the day it was created, in as far as you can. Hannah is from a different school of thought, which says that the wear, the damage, all of that is now part of the history of this volume, and that you shouldn't interfere with that. So she sees her job as just protecting the book and doing what's necessary to mean that it can be studied by scholars and put on exhibition.
Studied by scholars. In a way, when I was reading this, I said, my gosh, this is like forensic art, because she's exploring the past through the pigmentation, the...
One of the things that was so fascinating for me was to learn what book conservators actually do. And these are incredible people because they're scientists. They have to know chemistry. They have to know, understand how the pigments were made and the chemical construction and the molecular reorganization that goes on in parchment and all this stuff. But they have a very finely honed aesthetic sense as well. And they're also sleuths. And this was the most surprising thing to me. When you work on an old manuscript, a conservator will be looking for any clue, like some little piece of scrap of quill pairing in the binding, and that could give all kinds of information. What kind of bird did it come from? What was the geographic range of that bird? Might tell you where the book was.
When did the bird live?
Was it from an extinct species, or is it a species that was only in South America until a date certain when the first, for instance, Muscovy ducks were brought to Europe? I think it was sometime in the 1600s. Before that, a Muscovy duck quill pairing wouldn't have appeared in a European book, so then you know you've had a forgery. You can find out all kinds of things just from a breadcrumb, for example. And so conservators are always on the hunt. And that gave me the idea that each little artifact that Hannah takes out of the binding would be the open door for the reader to go back and be a witness when that little thing got into the book and see the moments in this book's history that were so crucial.
Let's talk about a couple of the other characters in the book. We've talked about Hannah, who's the conservator. And then explain how she's brought into the story.
So she's an Australian, and she gets a call in the middle of the night. And as somebody who was born and raised in Australia, I can tell you that Americans and Europeans, for some reason, can never get the time right.
Well, I never remember. Is it 15 hours ahead or 15 hours behind?
Exactly. Well, you're not alone. Anyway, so she gets woken up and she's called in. She's offered the job of a lifetime, which is to evaluate and conserve the Haggadah, which had been missing during the Bosnian War and has just come to light and been returned to the museum. And the UN wants to put it on display because the book is a sort of a symbol of the survival of the multi-ethnic ideal of Sarajevo that's been so battered by ethnic cleansing and violence. But this is a book made by Jews who've lived peacefully in Sarajevo with their Muslim and Christian neighbors, and the book has been saved twice by Muslim librarians from destruction.
That's interesting. Muslim librarians have saved Jewish works of art.
At least two occasions, and this is true, that we know of, this book was saved by Muslim hands, once from the Nazis and once from destruction by ultranationalist Serbian
bombing. Now, this is real.
That's
authentic.
True. We know that. And the story during World War II is particularly amazing. The librarian knew that the Nazis wanted this book for a particularly grotesque idea of the Führer, that after all the Jews in Europe had been exterminated, he was going to have a little museum of the extinct race. Mm. And so the Nazis were busily looting the best Judaica to stock this museum. And they came for the Haggadah, a general, no less, and the librarian told the museum director that he wasn't going to hand it over. And he tucked it in the waistband of his trousers and put his coat over the book. And he was a wonderful linguist, and so he spoke German. So he went to translate between the director and the general and told the general that, terribly sorry, but one of your officers came to the museum some weeks ago and took the book. And the general, incensed, says, name the man. And he says, oh, well, we didn't think it was our place to require a name.
Because it was very common for this army that really was established to go around and loot
all of these incredible looters.
Museums,
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So it was not unlikely that one of his men did loot or steal the book.
Well, apparently he bought it. Anyway, the librarian walked out under his nose with the book in his trouser belt and took it out of Sarajevo up into the mountains where a friend of his was the imam of a little mosque, and that's where it safely spent the war.
I noticed the book is dedicated to librarians.
Indeed. I think, librarians were very important to me as a child. When I was growing up, we didn't have a lot of money, you know, so we got our books from the library and stacks of them every week. But also when I was in Sarajevo during the war, working then as a journalist, you couldn't fail to be bowled over by the courage of the librarians, because one of the really grotesque things that happened during the siege of Sarajevo was that the fanatics didn't just want to wipe out a people. They wanted to wipe out the record that a people such as Sarajevo's people had existed living together, many cultures. And so they deliberately shelled the libraries and the museums. And one of the librarians actually gave her life evacuating books, and others risked theirs time and again to try and bring these volumes, this shared human history, to safety.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines of People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks. In 2006, Geraldine earned the Pulitzer Prize for her novel March, centered around the father of the girls of Little Women. Her stint as a Wall Street Journal reporter covering the war in Bosnia exposed her to the fate of the Sarajevo Haggadah, one of the earliest illuminated medieval Hebrew books rescued from the National Museum in Sarajevo. There are some other unique characters in this book. The Catholic priest that approved, or that was given the responsibility of approving which books could stay and which would be burned and banned.
He was a censor for the Pope's Inquisition, and he was based in Venice. And he's a historical figure. And we know that the actual Sarajevo Haggadah was in Venice in 1609 because he wrote that on the flyleaf when the book came into his hands, and he was charged with rooting out anything heretical or offensive to the Catholic Church. And he passed the Haggadah, and that meant that it was saved from the fires that consumed so many Hebrew books at that time.
What about the World War II resistance fighters?
So I was very interested in the young people who risked everything to join the anti-Nazi resistance, and they were in the mountains of Yugoslavia living in very harsh conditions. So I have a character who is a young woman, a Jewish woman, who is fighting with Tito's partisans in the mountains until her unit is disbanded. And then she makes her way back to her city, and all her family has already been killed by the Nazis. And she's offered refuge by a very unlikely couple, a Muslim and his wife. They take her in and hide her from the Nazis.
One of the other interesting aspects of the book is the gambling, the occurrence of how the Haggadah was actually became a piece in a gambling or a game of chance, if you will.
Well, this is invention. I was trying to. We don't know why the Catholic censor Domenico Vistorini passed this book when so many others were consigned to the flames, and so I've created a scenario, and it's about an unlikely friendship between a priest and a rabbi in Venice in 1609, and the limits to that friendship.
Right.
And each man has a weakness. The priest's weakness is alcohol, and the rabbi's is gambling. And so we come to a point where the book becomes the stake in a very fraught gambling game that is really the two men working out their differences.
That's a good part of the book. I enjoyed that. You also speak about the ghetto, and the word is spelled G-E-T-O in the book. Speak to that for a moment.
So when I started out to write the Venice section of the history of the Haggadah, I didn't know what was going on in Venice in 1609, so I had to research that period. And I learned that we actually get the word ghetto from Venice of that time. It was the first time that Jews were actually required to live in a segregated part of the city. And the word ghetto means metal foundry. And so the Jews were required to live on a little island in Venice that had once served as the city's metal foundry. And the bridges that linked the island with the rest of the city were locked at night. And the Jews were confined in there, and that was the only place they were really supposed to be living. So quickly the buildings grew multi-story, and they were the tallest structures in Venice of that day, and it was a very crowded quarter, but very rich and interesting because the Jews who came to Venice were coming from all kinds of different backgrounds. Some were the people who'd been exiled from Spain and Portugal. Others were Levantine traders, and others were German loan bankers. So it was a polyglot multicultural community within itself.
And they were basically confined to those three trades, too, weren't they?
They were either bankers or secondhand dealers. They weren't supposed to publish. That was one of the things that was a profession that was denied to them. But a number of them were also physicians. And
oh, yes.
Those were the privileged ones,
yes.
Because the great and good of Venice needed their services.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So they were spared, so to speak. It was you have an interesting story in there about a young man who's trying to get out of the ghetto. No. Help me out here.
So my rabbi who has the gambling problem.
Right.
And this was another thing that was great fun to research, what kind of gambling was going on in Venice at that time. And there were sort of clandestine casinos, sort of vaguely tolerated places where you could go and play all kinds of gambling games. And he takes advantage of the period Carnevale, where everybody is wearing masks, so he can pass himself off as a Christian and sneak out of the ghetto with a bunch of rowdy young Christians and go off and gamble all night.
So the Christians come in and out of the ghetto,
yes,
at will, but the Jews had to be...
At night, the gates were locked and the Jews were all supposed to be inside. Although, you know, there was a wonderful quote in one of the old documents that I read that says, with money and friends, you can do anything in Venice.
I believe that. You had a couple of chapters, and I, unfortunately, if we go into them, we're going to give away some of the stuff, but... I have to mention, though, the saltwater chapter. I just have one question. What makes salt kosher?
Yeah. It's not that the salt is kosher. It's not that it's holy salt or anything. It's just that it's the kind of salt that you can use to get the blood out of meat, because if you're making meat kosher, you have to brine it. And better, you should have salt with a big grain structure to do that with.
Ah. Oh.
Wine, on the other hand, is a lot more complicated. Kosher wine must not have any protein in it. And usually in the old days, they would use egg whites to clarify wine, but kosher wine won't have any egg whites used. They use a kind of very fine earth to clarify it instead. So that becomes a plot point for my book conservator sleuth when she's trying to get to the bottom of a wine stain.
Right, right. That's why I called it forensic art. Yeah. And speaking of art, was it really true? You had mentioned earlier about the figurines that were, or rather the illuminations that were not approved by the Jewish faith because of them being in the imagery of a god. Let's talk about that just a little bit, because in your book you talk about how small these miniaturist could be. And you even mentioned a little, what was that,
there's a famous example where there's a long staple grain of rice.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
Which
about.
Is not very big. And on it there's a whole polo match.
A polo
painted.
Match.
Yes.
On a grain of rice.
Yes. So these people worked with brushes of only a single Persian cat hair. And they got these incredible miniature. I mean, their eyesight must have been phenomenal.
Oof. What eyesight? After 5 years, they probably...
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't make out too well on their retirement programs.
But it was fascinating how you talked about that in the book and the history of that, and how a single cat's hair, you know,
yeah,
was
and
used
to be
as
a
the brush.
Particular cat's hair. It had to be a white Persian cat, and it had to be a hair from under the throat area.
Wow. The book has survived, it seems, the same human disaster again and again. We mentioned the Spanish Inquisition, the Nazis, the extremist nationalist.
We're very slow learners, aren't we, as a species? We make these beautiful societies where we appreciate diversity and we're learning from each other and everybody's prosperous. And then up comes this fear of otherness and we smash it down again. And we've done it over and over again in human history. And it's very dispiriting.
It really is. And I think if we And I think if we go back, and I'm going back to art again here, because I think a lot of your book is about that to a certain degree, the role of art in public. It's a way that we can reach out to people and have a common point of reference, if you will, because as you know, art was used as a method of communication long before we became literal and before we were writing and so forth. So the symbology, I mean, the symbolism in the art from centuries ago.
Well, growing up in Australia, we have one of the oldest visual traditions in the world among the Aboriginal people. And, you know, this is 30,000 years ago, so it's almost, you know, mind-boggling. And you walk into these caves in the Northern Territory, and bam, you just get your socks knocked off you because of the beauty of the work that people were making in those days to try and explain their world, to appreciate their world. You know, we don't know the purpose behind some of the art in these caves, but it just, you just feel this hand reaching out to you in friendship from 30,000 years ago, and you feel you shared humanity very closely there.
Well, from the Aborigines to Geraldine Brooks, thank you so much, Geraldine. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you, Valerie.
Geraldine's latest book is People of the Book. That's it for this week. Until next time, I'm Valerie Jackson reminding you that there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or participate in the online book club. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. Executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Mike Johns. Technical producer, Ken Mary. Production assistant, Chichi Morka. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.